Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. I'll be the skipper for the program. We've got some great interviews that we think you'll enjoy. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio America. Veterans Radio America is a 501c3 nonprofit. All donations and sponsorships are tax deductible, and you can go to veteransradio.net to help out. A number of sponsors to thank before we get started. Legal Help for Veterans, a VA disability law firm at 1-800-693-4800. U.S. Wings, they're the manufacturers and distributors of those great leather jackets and military apparel. Go visit them at uswings.com. And National Veterans Business Development Council certifies service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. Check them out at nvbdc.org. And finally, the Eisenhower Center. Eisenhower Center's After the Impact programs provides rehabilitation for veterans, first responders, and professional athletes throughout an intensive 30 to 90 day evidence-based treatment program. Participants recovering from concussion, TBI, PTSD, anxiety, depression, and suspected CTE are immersed in an intensive transitional treatment program to treat multiple deficit areas. Check out EisenhowerCenter.com. And now let's move on to our interviews. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Greg Sumner, who's a professor of history at the University of Detroit Mercy and has written an interesting book on World War II prisoners of war who were brought over to the United States. Greg, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good to be here, Jim. I love talking about this very interesting and really kind of largely forgotten topic.
Well, let me set this up a little bit by explaining some of your background, and you have degrees from the University of Indiana, both bachelor's, master's, and PhD. You picked up a law degree at the University of Michigan, but you made your swerve back to teaching history many years ago. I think you've been at the University of Detroit Mercy for about 27 years. Time goes by quickly.
I'm now the old guard. I was the young Turk at one time.
But you, along the way, you have been a William J. Fulbright lecturer in Rome a couple of times, and the National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship a couple of times. So you've done a lot of interesting thing in this career of yours. Kind of an original passion was history, but you got back to it. And what we're here to talk about is a book called Michigan's World War II POW Camps. And this follows a book that you wrote called Detroit in World War II, both for the History Press. And I think, as you mentioned, this is a little bit of forgotten history. I think vaguely I remembered hearing about this, and fortunately I had the chance to hear you talk on this subject.
Yeah.
So I said, boy, we got to introduce him to our veteran radio listeners, because there's always some lessons to learn. And let's start, though, with, I think people would be generally surprised to hear how many Germans and Italians prisoners of war were brought back to the United States, how they were brought back, and where they were dispersed to. So this is a big, big story, but tell it to us in a nutshell.
Well, basically, as the war began to turn somewhat decisively in the Allied favor, beginning with our victories after Operation Torch, the defeat of the fascist forces in North Africa, and as we were, and this is May of 1943, well into the war, we're ready to move on to Sicily and Italy and ultimately D-Day. We had a very big logistical problem, the Americans and the British, but primarily the Americans. What are we going to do with all these captured Germans and Italians in North Africa? And, we had them in very temporary facilities out in the desert. There are sand fleas. There's not adequate sanitation. There's really no place to put these guys. We were expecting maybe 70,000 prisoners if things went well in North Africa. We had 225,000. So the wonderful George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, came up with a solution to this problem of what are we going to do with these prisoners, Germans and Italians. He said, let's ship them to the United States on these Liberty ships that are coming across to the war zone each week and heading back basically empty, these tin cans. Let's load these guys onto these ships, take them back to the States where we have ample resources to take care of them. They won't be much of a security risk. You know, if you're in the middle of Nebraska or the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you're probably not a big escape risk. But here's the other part of it. Brilliant two-for-one Yankee ingenuity by General Marshall. Under the Geneva Convention, which we followed, not everybody did, prisoners could work. They could volunteer to work for a kind of token wage so long as it was not, quote, war-related work. And General Marshall noted, we've got one heck of a labor shortage in the United States, particularly in agriculture. And he said, we'll ship these guys over. We'll treat them according to the conventions. 95% of the prisoners ultimately volunteered. They liked working because it passed the time. And they did get a small token compensation for that. And it worked well. I talked to a couple of Michigan daughters of Michigan farmers who had Germans picking apples in Berrien County or working in the lumber industry. They said these guys were kind of a godsend because so many people, you know, men were gone. They were in uniform. There were people working in war plants. Farm labor in particular done by Germans and Italians was, you know, helped to save a lot of crops and were very important to our continued home front efforts.
And this is one of those things that you, when you say it out loud, you go, well, that makes sense, but I suspect.
Sure.
I suspect.
Only Marshall thought of it, though. The one,
right.
He should be a household name today, if I can give a plug for General George Marshall.
No, brilliant. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this was a, you know, a huge logistics issue, if you think about it. You bring in them back in Liberty ships, and there were about, 425,000 prisoners of war brought back. That's a lot of Liberty ship trips. But you now got to move them, don't you? I mean, they're coming into port in New York or somewhere on the East Coast. How do we move them around the country?
Good question. This was being, you know, created on the fly. And it was somewhat of an experiment. And again, as I look back at World War II, and I study the home front very carefully, I'm amazed by the ingenuity and the way people were able to come up with these kind of practical solutions. The first thing that happened after a very arduous trip across the Atlantic, somewhat dodging U-boats, etc., these guys land in New York, Boston, Virginia. They're shocked to see our eastern seaboard cities intact, and they begin to think, well, maybe the Third Reich isn't winning this war after all. They are processed. They tried to keep the program initially secret from the general public, and that utterly failed. People were there observing them, gawking at them as they came down the gangplanks. They processed them. They deloused them. They tagged them. They issued them work fatigues that have PW stenciled all over them. And then they loaded them onto these trains, basically a lot of Pullman cars that had been stripped of their luxuries. And they are sent west initially to places in the deep south and the southwest, as far as New Mexico, even California. The Midwest, I talk about Michigan, the Midwest began to lobby and said, we want some prisoners too. So they made, you know, the first Germans arrive in September of 43 at Benton Harbor, Michigan to pick fruit. And I think the most remarkable thing to both the Germans and the Italians, and it was mostly Germans, the most remarkable thing to them, the thing that shocked them, was the scale of our country. You know, how long does it take a train from New York during wartime to New Mexico? One German was said to have told his mates, this is a Yankee Hollywood trick. They're taking us around in circles. No country can be this big.
Well,
And once, and, you know, so they had a lot of surprises once they got here. They were amazed to see, as they looked out through the barred windows, Americans driving their own automobiles. It just seemed like an impossibly abundant, wealthy, and gigantic nation. So they were pretty disoriented by the time they got to the barracks where they were ultimately kept, not only in 6,000 in Michigan, 425,000 nationally.
How many camps were around the country, Professor, and where were they all concentrated in the South? Because we've got not only do we have a large country geographically, but, you know, temperature, weather-wise, terrain-wise, it's a pretty impressive country.
Yeah, it's a continent, basically. And, well, initially the War Department thought, let's send them to the warmer climes. There's a demand for all kinds of labor down there, and you don't have to heat buildings in the wintertime. But as I said, the Great Lakes states, including my own Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, realized that this cheap labor was a valuable resource. They lobbied. So, you know, ultimately, there were camps in, I believe I read 49 out of 50 states, or 47 out of 48 states, excuse me. It was only 48 states back then. This was truly a nationwide program. And Michigan got its share, and people were really kind of state governments were fighting to get this cheap labor, and they were all over the country. There were 32 camps identified in Michigan. And when I say camps, there were base camps. You put them in military establishments. For instance, Fort Custer is where the German and Italians were processed in Michigan. They put them in CCC camps, certainly in the wintertime. They put them out in racetracks and in fairgrounds. They all kinds of improvised places where they could store these guys. But I want to, when I say 32 camps in Michigan, 500 nationally, a lot of them were very brief, temporary tent camps, as men were brought in for a harvest and then they were moved on to the next harvest. So a lot of them, you know, there's nothing left of them. A lot of them were brief tent camps.
Well, let me ask about Professor Greg Subner of the University of Detroit Mercy History Department. How did the public respond to this? Because I can imagine that during this time of war, where men are dying and men are being captured and American soldiers are being captured and being treated as POWs by the Germans or the Japanese, that this program where these guys are out and about kind of picking fruit in the day and at these minimum security camps at night may have caused some concerns in the general public. How was it perceived?
Oh, yes. There was some initial resistance in the idea of Nazis and fascists coming into our small town in Michigan or Missouri or Nebraska. There were people who did not like the idea. They worried about security concerns. And also, and I fully understand this idea, my brother's in a ditch over at San Lo, and you're bringing these Germans over here, and we're treating them pretty well. You know, there was some resentment, and a lot of my research had to do with looking at small town newspapers and letters to the editor. And you do see some people, who are these Nazis who are being brought into our area? That was kind of the initial response. I think most people kind of suspended judgment. And really, the thesis of my book is, as they got here, and the War Department did make its best effort to weed out the bad guys. There were bad guys. They were mostly homesick young guys, late teens, early 20s. They worked hard. They cooperated. They kind of won over the locals pretty quickly. They worked hard because they liked working. So there was this initial resistance. And then the other thing I always saw in letters to the editor, you can just hear the anger in them. These guys are being coddled. And once again, you know, I've got my husband is off, you know, in some godforsaken place and on a war front. You know, why are we treating these guys so well? They're being mollycoddled is the actual word. In fact, you know, they had pretty Spartan conditions. There was plentiful food. which was something, you know, there were a lot of exaggerations about how they were being treated. I would call the conditions like a boot camp almost. And so, yes, the initial resistance was there. Some people never accepted it. But I think the real thesis of my book is that when these guys got to be known and got to know even farm families that they worked for, individual farm families, as they got to know guards, as they got to know camp personnel, as they were seen around town, as they played with kids, wasn't perfect, but generally speaking, these guys were kind of welcomed and treat. My thesis is you get to know human beings in an intimate level, you treat them like human beings. And that's why the program worked. And I also want to say, I don't talk about Japanese POWs. There were no camp. There are a couple of small, very heavily armed camps where Japanese prisoners were bought. But that Pacific War was a whole different ball game. These guys were mostly pretty good with minimum security. We allowed their own officers to do most of the discipline. And there weren't big problems at all. And that one other factor, there are so many in Michigan, for instance, so many Germans, German descent people, and so many Italian descended people, that in many cases, you know, they're speaking the native tongue with these guys. This is my long-lost cousin or nephew or something. So the general, after this initial resistance, I think people kind of embraced it, and to the point where, you know, one of the great stories, this is a story America should be proud of. A lot of these guys ended up coming back after the war. They all had to be repatriated, but they found a way to come back either to bring their families to see people, Americans they'd gotten to know, or a large number of them became American citizens. So they had a pretty positive experience for the most part. And I think we had classes in democracy. We tried to kind of teach them, you know, non-fascist, non-Nazi ways. Those really didn't work. What really convinced these guys that we had some good values over here were their interactions with ordinary Americans, who for the most part treated them pretty well.
Well, and I think there's a, you know, as you said, there was a need for laborers. There was a need for, sure, for men to be working in the logging industry or the agricultural industry. So there was probably an appreciation that, hey, the farm got the fruit picked, and we made a little bit of money to survive to next year. The men got paid a little bit of money, but not U.S. dollars. Explain how that worked.
Well, under the Geneva Convention, they are entitled to kind of a token compensation. There are all kinds of rules. Had to be safe working conditions, non-war-related work, which was interpreted rather liberally. The maximum 10-hour day, 6 days a week. They could make up to 80 cents a day, basically. And what they got was at the end of each work week, a coupon or a voucher or scrip, which they could use to go to whatever the camp was. It had a little PX where they could buy writing paper and razor blades and Wrigley's chewing gum, Chesterfield cigarettes, which they traded with the guards a lot, Hershey bars. And I point out at a big place like Fort Custer, you know, in 1944, there were 5,000 Germans living at Fort Custer in Michigan. They had their own bar. They were allowed to buy alcohol, to buy one beer, watered down ration beer, 3-2 beer, 10 cents a piece, one per customer. You know, they spent the money as quickly as they got it, and they were kind of shocked that they were even getting paid. And I want to say, why did we follow the Geneva Convention? Why did we treat them, you know, why did we treat them so, you know, kind of humanely? There were a number of reasons. One is we were a signatory to the Geneva Convention, and we keep our word. We're the good guys in this war. We're not going to stoop to the other side's what they're doing. There also was this hope, which I'm not sure it worked out, that as word got back through the Red Cross and other means that we were treating Germans in particular well, maybe our guys who were being held prisoner would get a little bit better treatment. That didn't really pan out very well, but that was kind of the thinking. It made sense not only in terms of, you know, it's the right thing to do, but it was a practical thing to treat them well to pay them, to give them safe accommodations, et cetera.
Well, it does raise that big issue of, you know, does that experience, and there was a little bit of this in World War One, not much, but a little bit of bringing POWs back to the U.S. in World War One. But does this experience, as you look at it, tell us anything on how Americans should or could wage war?
Yeah, that's a tough question, and we're talking about in the year 2020. We're, 75 years removed from World War II. It was a different time. It's difficult. You know, we have Guantanamo Bay as an example of completely segregating people who are war prisoners or terrorists. It's hard to say. I think the thing we want to stay away from is just kind of demonizing the enemy. And understanding that a lot of the soldiers that we might be fighting are young men, kind of like our guys are. And the less we can kind of dehumanize, probably the better it is. If you've got a full-blooded terrorist, you're probably not going to have them interacting with the general population. But if you can maintain security, there's no need to demonize unnecessarily. And I think we do that, you know, there's a racial element to that. I think that was a problem for the Japanese were portrayed in World War II as subhuman rats and rodents. And, you know, they did Pearl Harbor, so the anger was very palpable there. Post 9/11, a lot of anger at many people in the Arab world and so forth. The racial things play into this. But I think the message for us is to try to minimize dehumanizing the enemy. And wherever possible, try to interact with them as human beings. And then, you know, if a war ever ends, and this was another thought that our War Department had in General Marshall, once these guys went back to Germany and Italy, they're going to rebuild. They're going to have some democratic values, maybe. They're going to try to rebuild their countries, maybe in a more progressive direction. So, you know, it's very hard to say in the age of the war and terror on terror. But again, I think dehumanization is the problem. And I read a lot of war literature and novels. And, you know, even you keep reading about how, you know, the French and the Germans kind of understood in 1914, the soldiers kind of understood, you guys are kind of like us. That is the antidote to things. But it's difficult today. I would agree with that.
Well, I think that's one of the things, and we're talking to history professor Gregory Sumner from the University of Detroit Mercy about his book, Michigan's World War II POW Camps, and he also wrote on Detroit in World War II. But
and
I think
you already outed me. I'm actually a Hoosier from Indianapolis.
You are.
I keep writing books about Michigan and Detroit and also really World War II I'm interested in.
But I think the question, I guess, this gets me to, because you do get to carry the PhD and the professor title, is have we simply just forgotten some of these history lessons that when you look back and say, well, boy, we should have, you know, carried this forward, or years ago, what happened to this idea? How do you feel about whether or not these lessons from history have been learned?
Well, you and I were talking before we started recording that Americans are not great at learning lessons from history or remembering our history. And that's kind of the life mission I'm on, is to tell stories, particularly to my college age students, who barely know who we were fighting in World War II. I try to engage them with these human stories. They tend to be forgotten. And I've talked, as I traveled around Michigan, for instance, to talk about POW camps, I ran into a lot of, I never knew there were Italians here. I never knew there were Germans here. Nobody talked about it. And I'm not sure quite why that would be the case. Most of the camps, there's not much left of them, if anything, a few artifacts. We just tend to not look back and I think maybe there's kind of an arrogance that all of us have toward the past, like, well, you know, it's not so important, or they were dumber back then or something. Actually, the past can see these from General Marshall on down, they were doing some very wise things. And my mission is to tell these interesting stories to particularly engage younger people in World War II, to show that human beings are human beings. And you can kind of learn, you can learn from things. And I've gotten a very good reception as I've gone around and spoken to library audiences. But I will tell your audience, we got a problem. Because I've been all over the state of Michigan giving talks on World War II, and hardly anybody shows up under 50. You know, young people are probably less historically literate than ever today. So we need to make sure they carry on these stories and understand and respect them. And I think the way you do that is by drawing them into the individual human stories.
Oh, I agree with you, Greg, and that's why we do Veterans Radio, is to try to keep these stories alive. And and one of the, I'm gonna put a little sizzle here, so folks might get this book and give it to their grandkids or their kids. And well, you've got stories of escapes. There's a teenage love story involved here that turns into a prison sentence. Yes. So you got sex, drugs, and rock and roll here, essentially.
Jim, I'm waiting to find an agent to do some movie rights. It's a great story.
It is a great story, and there's tragedy. We don't have time to talk about the Blissfield 16, but 16 German POWs, I think some guards as well, lost their life returning from the fields working in a truck train accident. So
kind of a freak accident, yes.
Yeah. So as you say, you're telling human stories, and human stories have all of that. They have the good of it, the excitement of the Germans playing soccer and teaching soccer to the locals to heartbreak. And so we'd encourage people to grab your books. Tell us where they might be able to find them, and give us the titles again.
I think the best way is just to go to Amazon, and it's the History Press. They do local histories around the country. The first book is Detroit in World War II. And that was a fascinating story for me to get into, and all the interesting aspects of that. Detroit in World War II and Michigan POW camps. Michigan POW camps in World War II. Both are from the History Press. You can go to the History Press site also, but I just do Amazon.
And it's Professor Greg Sumner. We want to thank you for taking some time today to talk to Veteran Radio listeners.
I had a great time, Jim. Thank you.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month, or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.